6th Court of Appeals, in and for the 7th Judicial Circuit. Hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. Back to the United States and its honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Hudson against the Chicago Transit Authority. Mr. Gonzalez.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I want to focus on what I believe are the three strongest reasons why a reasonable jury might conclude that the CTA discriminated against Mr. Hudson and breached its settlement contract with him. First, the record contains some rather peculiar and unexplained facts. The district court denied summary judgment on two breach of contract counts, and the facts related to those counts, I argue, have great significance to the issues before this court today. They provide some insight into the motives of the decision makers, and they help support a reasonable inference that the decision makers denied Mr. Hudson the promotional opportunities because they resented him for having sued and settled a case against the CPA. Consider the matter of the peculiar absence of any job assignments to Mr. Hudson. The district court found, in appendix page 825, the court found it was undisputed that the CTA refused to give Mr. Hudson any job assignment for at least some period of time in 1998. And it found that Mr. Hudson kept asking for assignments. Mr. Hudson himself testified that he repeatedly asked his supervisors for assignments. Also, the district court found that an involuntary transfer of this lifelong electrician to a job doing data entry and clerical work was a breach of that contract, which required the CTA to employ him as a coordinator.
Let me tell you a general problem. I'm not sure how it matters whether that settlement agreement was not honored. It seems to be a premise of your argument that not to honor a settlement agreement of a federal claim is itself a violation of federal law. But the Supreme Court held in the Kokkonen case that that's not correct, that breach of a settlement agreement is just breach of contract. It's not a breach of federal law. And we held in McGuire against the City of Springfield that breach of a settlement agreement is also not a form of retaliation. It's just not actionable under federal law. So my principal question for you is, what significance is it that your client may not have gotten all the benefits provided by the settlement agreement?
Well, perhaps, Your Honor, I'm being a little inarticulate when I keep saying breach of the settlement agreement. What I'm really talking about is some facts that came out in the district court in discovery, those being that he's left with no job assignments for an appreciable period of time, even though he keeps asking for them, and that they transfer an electrician to a data entry job. All I'm suggesting is that those, if they were explained somewhere in the record, but it's not as though the CTA ever explains. The record is silent on why he was idle and why he ended up doing a data entry job. The CTA does speak to the latter move, but only to say that they felt that it was an important job and somebody needed to do it. So my argument is that that's a peculiar way to treat a lifelong electrician without some other explanation in the record that the jury might choose to believe. The CTA also argues that those facts are off the table. They're saying, well, you won that. That has nothing to do with these issues. But I think a reasonable jury wouldn't compartmentalize that way. I think they would look at the entire series of things that the CTA did to Mr. Hudson, the entire way they treated him, and they would view it as one series of events, especially in view of the fact that Mr. Hudson's previous supervisor had recommended him for promotion to at least one of the positions. That in at least one of them, the one that went to Mr. Tom Droz, Mr. Hartman acknowledged that Mr. Hudson was the better candidate on paper. And I say this only to make the point that even in the CTA's eyes, he was a good and talented employee. So why would he be left idle? Why would he be transferred to data entry, given that even in their eyes, he was a good employee? The second point I want to try to make is that statements made by Mr. Hartman and Mr. Maloney provide some insight into this otherwise unexplained treatment. At his deposition, Mr. Hartman confessed to, quote, a negative feeling, end quote, about Mr. Hudson. Now, admittedly, that is an ambiguous statement. I'm not suggesting that it is a declaration of an intent to retaliate against anybody. But my argument is, why would Mr. Hartman have a negative feeling about a man whose own supervisor recommended him for promotion, and even Mr. Hartman agreed was the best candidate on paper for one of the positions? And remember that this is the same Mr. Hartman that the CTA claims throughout their brief barely even knew Mr. Hudson. But I think the statements of Mr. Maloney are also telling. Mr. Maloney testified at his deposition that when Mr. Hudson was in his office with a Mr. Tom Rackey, that's another man who had also sued the CTA, Mr. Maloney testified, quote, Mr. Rackey has a common bond with Mr. Hudson, I might want to call it, because he has litigation with the CTA. I am sure that's what they were in there talking about, end quote. Again, an ambiguous statement, but one that I argue a jury might find suggest some ill will toward Mr. Hudson for having sued the CTA and settled with them, and I think they'd couple it with the absence of job duties, which is unexplained in the record, and the data entry transfer. The CTA argues that those statements are too remote in time from the actual promotion denials, that they lack any probative value because they're more like stray remarks within the meaning of discrimination law that really add up to nothing. But I would argue that there's a significant difference between stray remarks made, say, a year or so before a promotional decision by a decision maker, and remarks that are made by the decision makers themselves at their own depositions, where the issue before them is the promotion denials of the case. I think that that is a better insight into the attitudes of the decision makers. Finally, my final point that I want to emphasize is the evidence that centers around the importance that the CTA places on gaining experience as an acting manager. The CTA continues to insist that the reason they chose many of these applicants over Hudson is that they had more acting manager experience, while simultaneously they were denying that active manager experience to Mr. Hudson, even though we argue they were under a contractual obligation, in his case, to provide it. And I realize that this court has ruled many times that there's nothing wrong with subjective promotional decisions. There's no law that requires an employer to hire the best candidate on paper if it sees something in someone else that it likes. But for at least three of these promotions, the ones that went to Mr. Droz, Mr. Rickson, and Mr. Harjung, the CTA emphasized the extent of their acting manager experience. And through those acting assignments, and in other ways as well, the CTA itself gave the very opportunities to those applicants to be impressive, while Mr. Hudson sat idly with no assignment. For example, Mr. Hartman chose Mr. Kelly and Mr. Droz in two of the promotions because he had assigned Mr. Kelly the job of helping improve the Wilson Avenue station. And he had made Mr. Droz an acting manager. And Mr. Hartman said that they impressed him in those roles. Mr. Hartman put them in positions where they could impress him. At the same time, though, Mr. Hudson had a written contract guaranteeing him the right to serve as an acting manager, which we argue was breached. The CTA criticizes Mr. Hudson for a lack of proactivity as one of their articulated reasons, but it is unclear what else he could have done other than what he did, which was keep asking for assignments. Clearly, he wasn't free to just show up at the Wilson Avenue station and start ordering electricians about. He kept asking for assignments and wasn't getting them. Similarly, Mr. Cargill cited the acting experience of Mr. Harjung and the acting experience of Mr. Rickson as being key to their promotions. In fact, Mr. Rickson had been in that acting manager role for an entire 7 months before he was promoted, from January of 1998 through his promotion in August of 1998. The CTA cites this court's decision in Hughes versus Derwinski, arguing that an employer is under no requirement to be fair in allowing acting assignments or handing out these acting managerial assignments. But the critical difference here, I think, is that Mr. Hudson settled his previous suit against the CTA 5 days into a trial in exchange for a written promise that would allow him to gain that very acting manager experience. Finally, the district court granted summary judgment on that breach of contract count, the one concerning the right to act as a manager. The district court, I'm sorry, I see that I'm entering rebuttal time. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Gonzalez. Ms. Patel.
May it please the court, my name is Michelle Patel. I represent the Chicago Transit Authority, the defendant appellee in this matter. There's no evidence in the record that the promotions at issue were motivated by discriminatory animus towards the appellant. Rather, the record demonstrates that the promotions were granted to those individuals who the decision makers believed would take charge and make the changes. Those were the things that the CTA needed at the time. Those reasons are well supported in the record. I'd like to address each of the three strongest reasons that opposing counsel has addressed. First, the fact that, as he claims, Mr. Hartman was assigned to a position where he had no job duties. As the record bears out, and is in clear, what is made clear by Hartman's or Hudson's own testimony was that he was out for extended period of time in late 1997. At the time, he was a coordinator of carpenters and painters. When he returned in early 1998, two people were assigned to take over his duties. At the same time, Hartman admits that the CTA West Shop was going through a time of transition. Hartman or Hudson was told that he was going to be transferred to work under Mary Ward. The job that he was going to be doing were jobs that were considered to be important to the CTA to help with efficiency, etc. Mr. Hudson testified during his deposition that he didn't want to work under Mary Ward and that he didn't go see her out immediately for job assignments because he thought he was going to get something better. And this is all in his deposition testimony. So he sat around for a couple of months. And it's clear that it's undisputed that when he first returned in 1998, he sat around for 2 weeks before asking for work. He did not just do data entry working under Mary Ward. He did jobs such as inventorying, doing reports, basically helping the running of wash shops, and frankly, he had those computer skills. Well,
that left him really a coordinator in name only, didn't it?
Pardon?
He was a coordinator in name only at that point, then, right?
No, he had the same benefits, you know.
No, in terms
same
of
pay.
What he did, in terms of what he did daily, he didn't operate as the other coordinators did, right?
He acted as similar to how he acted when he had the coordinator of material maintenance.
Well, he didn't manage anybody. He didn't make work assignments. Isn't that what coordinators do?
I think the coordinator job title in the West Shop, the way it's used, is pretty broad. It describes the level of pay. It describes the level of responsibility. I don't think it specifically means that you're going to be...
Managerial responsibility, right? And that was the whole point. This man wanted to manage people. He wanted to be making assignments. He wanted to have that kind of exposure, which apparently you need to advance. And he wasn't getting it. He thinks he was in a dead-end job.
He was getting some very important job duties, and he worked with people in the trades in those jobs doing those job duties. And, you know, it wasn't a transfer that came out of nowhere. Like I said, it was a transfer that came during a time of transition. A transfer came after he was out and other people had to take over his responsibilities. And the other reason why the record shows the transfer was made was because he had computer skills, and he had those, and not many other people at the time, frankly, at LatchUp had those skills. And he had those skills by virtue of the job that he bargained for in the 1995 settlement agreement, which was manager of materials coordinator. So that's why he was looked upon when some of the tasks needed to be completed under Mary Ward. That's why they looked towards Mr. Hudson at the time.
What was her title at the time?
I think she was a director of administration, something to that effect. I don't know the exact title. So there were important responsibilities. He wasn't docked in pay. He wasn't docked in title. He simply was called upon because he had some specific qualifications and that he needed, and that wasn't something that was unusual at the WatchUp at the time. I mean, the senior vice president at the time was going out and cleaning rail stations. He was washing windows. He really wanted to move customer facilities along in the CTA. That was very important for increasing our ridership at the time. And he really ran the shop in a way that he demanded from each of his employees to rise to the occasion, to do whatever they could to fulfill his goals and agenda, the CTA's overall purpose of moving people around the city of Chicago. And time and time again, as proven in the record, Mr. Hudson wasn't ready to heed that call. He had a very narrow view of what he seemed to be appropriate for him to do. For example, he didn't want to be a supervisor of janitors, and that was the reason why he gave for not applying to one of the promotions that was posted. He didn't want to do the work under Mary Ward, as mentioned, because that was considered, even though that was considered to be very important work, because that, again, was beneath him. And even under Mary Ward, when he was asked to inventory the Hawthorne Center in mid-1998, he only counted those items inside the center. He didn't bother to keep track of items being taken out. And when asked in his deposition why he didn't bother to do that, he said, "Nobody specifically instructed me to do so." So all those facts show that Hudson really wasn't fitting into the criteria that Hartman and all the other decision makers were looking for at the time when they were making these promotions. They had a new division. They had new positions to fill, and the record firmly demonstrates that those who demonstrated go-getter, I'm going to go out and make a change qualities, were promoted, and Hudson simply didn't exhibit those qualities. Next, I wanted to address the statements made by Hartman and Maloney. I guess there's two statements, and they're made in depositions taken of Jack Hartman and Mark Maloney. Appellant asserts that those comments are very important. However, the district court correctly found that Hartman and Maloney's comments do not support an inference of discriminatory animus towards the appellant, and that in making his argument, appellant misconstrues and takes the comments out of context. While appellant asserts that Hartman stated he had negative feelings towards the plaintiff, the record demonstrates that Hartman stated that he had negative feelings towards appellant and that appellant should work harder if he wanted to move ahead. Hartman made that statement in response to the question whether he had any negative feelings about the appellant whatsoever. It wasn't made in response to a question of why didn't you promote Hudson. It wasn't made in response to a question about what were your reasons for promoting those individuals you did. And Maloney's comment was simply a comment made in speculation to why another colleague was spending an inordinate amount of time in Mr. Hudson's office, and he guessed that it was because they were talking about their suits against the CTA. Immediately after he said they had something in common, he said he didn't care if they were talking about the lawsuits, and that he just wanted to make sure that the other colleague, Mr. Rackey, was getting his work done because there was an established pattern that he wasn't. The appellant is the one that is construing that comment as sarcastic. There's nothing else in the record that would demonstrate that it is. And that's putting a twist on the comment in the record to favor your case is simply not something that's sufficient, you know, to bring your case to trial. There's no evidence in the record that ties the comments to the employment decisions at issue. As I already mentioned, Harmon made his comment in response to a question that had nothing to do with why he made the promotion. And the same thing with Mark Maloney's comment. They were made in depositions taken over a year and a half after the promotions were made. So, and although there were some questions put to Hartman and Maloney about some of the promotions, they made the comments at a time where that wasn't what the issue was in the deposition. Finally, I want to address Appellant's point about lacking active management experience. It's undisputed in the record that Mr. Hudson was given, rotated into his manager's job 4 to 5 times between September 1995 and the spring of 1998. Although the settlement agreement did say he would get rotation experience, it didn't guarantee that he would get every opportunity. The practice at the CTA is that you typically rotate into the manager who's ahead of you. And so Rickson, for example, who got to rotate into a senior coordinator position for a extended part of time, was simply lucky in the fact that he rotated and then the person left, and that's why he had the chance. It wasn't because Hudson was denied. If Hudson was rotated into every possible time that his manager left, it doesn't necessarily guarantee that, you know, that job in the future would be open, and I think that's important to remember. Also, when Cargo was talking about direct managing experience, and I think the talent kind of has glossed that over a little bit, he was talking about working as a foreman, and that's why Crackle and Krankovich were promoted. That was important to him, and Mr. Hudson clearly didn't have a foreman position at the CTA. He moved directly from being an electrician to a coordinator, and I think that's an important distinction to remember. And as for Kelly and Drell's working for the NSIP program, it was what they did. It wasn't the actual experience that made them more desirable for their job. It's how they took on that experience. And there's nothing in the record that shows that Mr. Hudson didn't have the opportunity to prove himself to Hartman in another way. It wasn't that working on the NSIP program was the only way to showcase your abilities to Hartman at the time. They were simply just cleaning windows and cleaning up subways. So, Hudson could have, you know, sought up some similar opportunity, and he simply didn't. Accordingly, the court should sustain the district court's order granting the CTA summary judgment on the claims at issue in this appeal. Appellant has not established the material issue of fact with respect to his claim. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Gonzalez?
Your Honors, may I briefly respond to a few of the CTA's points? They make the argument that when Mr. Hudson lost all his job duties, they were in a time of transition. But and that, again, they're saying that because there is no other explanation in the record. I don't think a reasonable jury is going to believe that between January of 1998 and April of 1998, the CTA had no electrical work that needed to be done. It's simply not the inference that a reasonable group of jurors is going to draw. I think the key, though, is the CTA has no other explanation in the record. They argue that Mr. Hudson resisted a suggestion that he go over to work for Mary Ward, whose title was Manager of Administration. It was a job outside of the trades. I don't think a jury would find that so unusual that he did resist that suggested transfer because he was trying to get ahead in his field, that being electronics. The CTA argues to you, but these were important job duties he was doing in the administration department. Well, they may have been, but in the CTA's eyes, they weren't important enough. because they weren't gaining him any currency when it came to these promotional opportunities. There, the CTA instead is pointing to people who got the kinds of opportunities that Mr. Hudson really wanted, opportunities to act within his line of work, his profession. We've never argued that the statements of these decision makers are confessions, but we think that they do give some glimmer into the thought processes and the attitudes. And I think the key is that they have to be put together with the treatment of Mr. Hudson, the idleness, the data entry job, and then choosing people for purely subjective reasons who gained the acting manager experience that he didn't. I don't think the CTA should balkanize this evidence. The Supreme Court tells us a plaintiff is entitled to the benefit of everything they've got, and if that adds up to what a reasonable jury might draw the inference in favor of the plaintiff, then they should be permitted to do so. Thank you for your attention.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel.